Dag Hammarskjöld was one of the greatest statesmen of the 20th century. I'm guessing for some of you, you've never heard that name before. He served as Secretary General of the United Nations in a critical period from 1954 until his untimely death in a plane crash in 1961. It was a time in which the world was still adjusting to the realities after World War II. The Cold War was intensifying between the superpowers, and so many of the countries that had been under colonial rule were coming to a place of independence, and there was a lot of conflict throughout the world. He traveled extensively, personally seeking peace at every opportunity, brokering treaties, working for a stable and a just world. Some people now believe that his plane was actually shot down to keep him from working toward a ceasefire in a war-torn area of Africa. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize after his death. And when they recovered his briefcase from the wreckage, they found in it the three things that he always took with him wherever he traveled: a copy of the United Nations Charter, a New Testament, and the Book of Psalms. He was a peacemaker, capital P, capital M, a man of deep spiritual commitment. He sought to follow the life of Jesus, and the Psalms were his prayer book. I wonder if we know the richness of the Psalms for our own lives, for the life of our worship together. They're a resource full of wonder, of insight, proclamation, but also pain and joy and thanksgiving. The Psalms can help us find words when ours fail. And I'm grateful that we have a reading from the Psalms each week in our liturgy, because I know that many Christians do not have opportunity to engage the Psalms in a corporate setting, and rarely a sermon from the Psalms. They may know the Psalms privately, but not as hymns and poems and prayers for the gathered people of God, which is what they are. That's how they were, that's how they came to be. I met my friend John in seminary. This is 25 years ago, and he was a number of years older, having spent 4 decades in a desert monastery. He was a Benedictine, and he left the monastery and came to seminary. And if you know anything about the monastic tradition, at least in the Benedictine tradition where he was, they sing and they pray the Psalms multiple times each day, up to 7 times a day. And so he knew the whole Psalter, that is the Book of Psalms, he knew it by heart. And, you know, he'd prayed through it at least once a month for 40 years. And it just filled his mind and his heart, and he could call it up in prayer. Or he would hear something and say, well, that's Psalm 68, or, you know. And it peppered his conversation over meals. And just whatever we were doing, there would be a line that would come up, and it would be from the Psalms, because his whole life up to this point had been bathed in this rhythm of praying and singing the Psalms. And I envied that knowledge of him. But not only the knowledge, but how he lived it out. He lived the Psalms. You see, the Psalms formed the hymn book for the people of God, of Israel. They were known intimately by the first Christians. It was the prayer book and the hymnal that Jesus knew and used. And it's been central to the devotional and worship life of the community of God since those 150 were first gathered together. So today, in a little different turn for us and for me, I'd like to reflect on Psalm 19, actually preach from the Psalm today, as I think it responds to the themes that we see in the other scriptures, the other readings, and it does so in a devotional and worshipful framework. It acts as a kind of prism for what we might see in the giving of the law, in Jesus cleansing the temple, and in Paul's words to the church at Corinth. It can encourage us in how to love God, how to live for God. So we're looking at Psalm 19. We have the whole psalm in front of us. Just a word that the psalm translation that we have printed each week comes from the Book of Common Prayer, which responds to the kind of rhythm in Hebrew rather than, it's a little different than what you would find in your NIV or other translations. Do you know C.S. Lewis thought that Psalm 19 was probably the greatest psalm? and even said that it was one of the greatest lyrics in the world. It is a psalm of praise, but it's also a royal psalm, which is a collection of psalms that have to do with the king, and with the king's rule, and maybe even the coronation of the king. We've been learning about some of the psalm forms in our Core at Nine, and in fact, Amanda taught on a psalm this morning. Specifically, we've been looking at psalms of lament. This is not a lament. It's not. It's a psalm of praise. And we know certain sections or verses of it by heart, don't we? I mean, there's a couple of things that jumped out at us as we read it. We know the first verse, I think, and we know the last. The first we know from Haydn's oratorio, The Creation, and other things like that. The heavens declare the glory of God. And the last verse is often prayed by preachers as they begin sermons. Right? It's a psalm that has three movements. It's like a journey that begins in the natural created world. It moves to the revelation of God in his law or instructions for life. And it ends with the response of confession and worship. So today I'd like us to walk through these three movements and see what we might learn and be inspired in. The first section, that is verses 1 to 6, starts with what everyone is able to see and know. That is, the world around us, like the beautiful morning today. Everyone who has eyes and even who can go out and feel the sun will experience the beauty of this morning. Anybody who lives around here. The sky overhead, the changing of day to night, and then the sun like a glorious champion running its course. See, there's nothing hidden here. And in fact, if one cannot see, there is still the heat of the sun that can be felt, the psalm says. And all of these things declare the glory of God, who is the maker. It's an interesting description, isn't it? Because the truth of their declaration is not with words. The truth of the declaration is in silence, but the message is unmistakable. The message fills the whole world, and the message is this: God is the maker. God has made us. God is worthy of glory. It's a psalm of praise that tells us that creation is actually an agent of mission, revealing a truth that's available to anyone who can see, a message that goes on every moment, day and night, night and day, with the created order in obedience to the sovereign Lord telling out his praise. I think it's actually one of the reasons we should have a sensitivity to the care of our planet and its resources, because they're not just here for us to consume and to use. They're here also to sing out the praises of God. And they did so long before we were given a voice. You know, I'm always intrigued by how people are drawn to natural beauty. We lived in Colorado for a number of years, and there's a lot of beauty there, what we call natural beauty, right? And I never got used to it. Wasn't one of those things where I got up in the morning and people who would visit say, look at that view of Pike's Peak. And I would go, oh yeah. I was always amazed by that. It was always a kind of an overwhelming reality that was there just in our backyard. And we know it in the ocean, when people visit the ocean or the painted desert or a blue sky that reaches from horizon to horizon, or even for those who are willing to see it, the prairie. Right? I think so. Such wonder touches even the hardest heart. People traveled great distances in recent months to catch the total eclipse of the sun. You remember that? Watching that on the news and following it. People marveled at it. Well, why? Why care? What does it touch in us? Why should we respond to that more than anything else? Why would most people rather live in Colorado than Nebraska? Nebraska's nice, nothing against Nebraska. I think it's because there's something in the way the person and the character of God are revealed in creation, and his glory is declared. It's a glory we desire to know, and there's something in us that responds to it, even if we don't have the language for it or even know what it is. Paul quotes something of this in the beginning of his letter to the church in Rome. He writes this: for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. But not everybody sees it, right? Not everybody is open to it. Not everybody can make those connections. I had a friend I went to high school with who became a commander of the space shuttle. And he did a couple of missions to outer space, and I remember hearing him on a radio interview. And the interviewer was leading him just to say, you know, when you're up there and you're looking at the planets and you see the Earth, and, you know, what does that wonder make you think of? You know, does it lead you to have questions about how the Earth began and so on? He said, well, it's interesting scientifically. See, he missed it. He didn't have the language to kind of respond to what was being declared and proclaimed. So not everyone grasped it. We know that. You know, praise is not the only thing going on here, though, in this first movement of the psalm. Scholars have suggested to us that the mention of the sun is very specific. And for good reason, because Israel was surrounded by pagan cultures. Some of them worshiped the sun as a deity. In fact, the Babylonians did, for one. So the psalmist, I think, is making clear that the sun is not a god, but the sun is made by God. The sun that rises and sets and follows its course across the sky does so in obedience to the Lord who has made it, the true creator God. Nature declares not itself, but the glory of the maker. The psalmist is telling Israel and telling us, you are different from those around you. You know the one that is behind all that you see, and it's declaring his truth to the whole world, but you have embraced it. Therefore, you know you are not like those who worship other gods, because God has made you as well, and you're in relationship with God. So we're already seeing a little polemic. There's something beginning in the psalm that says, you're the people of God. You're the people of God, and that means something in the way that you're going to live. Then the psalm has a second movement. It moves from the more general sort of natural theology, if we can use that term, to a revelation of God in a more specific way through the law, in the praise of the law. Now, it's referring to the Torah, of course, the teaching, the instructions for life. It does refer to the written law of God, the Ten Commandments that are given, for instance, but I believe it includes all the teaching of the Scriptures. It includes the wisdom of walking with God, and for us as Christians, the fullness of the revelation that we know in Jesus Christ. Here it's presented as law and statutes, precepts, commands, fear, and decrees of the Lord. These are the words that are used. And what's the psalmist say about this law? These instructions. It says they're perfect, they're trustworthy, they're right, they're radiant, they're pure and firm. It's the source of renewal and wisdom. It's the source of joy and endurance. Because by it we know the Lord, and we know what it is to live in the way that gives life and not death. When God gives the law written in tablets at Sinai, it's foundational to his covenant with them. It's actually relational at its heart. Relational with God, relational with one another. It marks them out. It marks the people of God out as different from all the others. This is what God declares to the people in Exodus 19. We had the reading from 20. Back up a few verses, we read this. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. See, that was a unique and special calling by God given to his people here. Some of the old translations, we see that word peculiar. Did you ever wonder about that? The people of God are peculiar. We know that, but that's not what it means. I mean, that meaning of we're strange, we're weird, we're different. But in its original meaning, peculiar means private property. If something is peculiar, it is owned, and it's private, it's exclusive. The people of God are peculiar. Peculiar. We have a peculiar relationship. We have a private, personal, unique relationship with God. The Ten Commandments were to give life, to provide joy as a sign that they were people of a special covenant, unlike the others in the world. They're not designed to constrict and limit our freedom, to take our joy away, right? But they're to provide the framework of life so that true freedom can be known and celebrated. They were a source of wisdom. They're still a source of wisdom. God's instruction, that is God's wisdom, is not the wisdom of the world, as Paul notes. In fact, God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, his weakness stronger than human strength. The theme of this psalm that's emerging as we walk through it is what we see in our other readings, that God has revealed himself and in that revelation called a people to be in a relationship with him, a special relationship. And the life that we live now as his people is not the life that is lived by those who are apart from God. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. It is true wisdom, and knowing the difference is important. Knowing how we are to live as God's people is important. It's critical. It's central to who we are. Jesus drives the money changers from the temple. Always a powerful image, isn't it? Whether we read it in John or one of the other gospels. He drives the animal sellers from the temple because this uniqueness of the relationship of the people of God to the Maker, the uniqueness of that has been compromised. See, people who traveled to Jerusalem for the Passover, they couldn't bring animals and so on with them, so they did need to pick up an animal. They also had to exchange money because to pay the temple tax, because Roman coinage had an image on it of Caesar, and they could not use that in the temple. So these were actually legitimate undertakings that were going on. They're legitimate transactions. But here in the temple, it had taken over. It had become not one of the things on the side that enabled the worship of God to take place. It became the focus of how they got things done. It had become the established system of what was important. The commerce of the world had encroached, moved into the temple courts, and become enshrined in how it functioned. See, the temple and its system had relinquished its special role, its unique role as a house of prayer, so that it was unable to recognize the one who was sent from God, sent to redeem and to save and to bring back to God's heart those that were far away. The temple had no ability to see that because prayer had been pushed out. It had become a place of commerce. This is why Jesus responds the way he does. Not to prove to us he's human, not to show us that he too can get angry. It's a passionate response to the loss of peculiarity that God's people have been given. And that compromise is always at our door. It's something the church must continually be attuned to, discerning of, and vigilant about. And I know this sounds a little strange to our ears because we're people of freedom, we're people of grace, we're very careful about, you know, legalisms and things like that, and we should be. But we're still God's people, called by him to live a certain way, not to live the life of the world, but to live the life of his redeemed people. And those are different. Those are different. Now, you know that I grew up among strict separationists. Anything looked like the world, we stayed away from, especially if it was public. If it was private, we didn't talk about it quite so much. And you know what? That is not the answer. That's not the answer. That's a type of legalism that actually, I think, does not know the beauty and joy of the law as Psalm 19 has described it. It doesn't. But the other direction, when the pendulum swings out, where the world and its values has entered the life of the church and become enshrined in the way things are done, that's the way of death, or at least it's the way of faithlessness and the loss of witness. I want to be careful here, and I don't want to just send you away thinking, man, what was Jay on about this morning? You know, he sounded kind of negative, and wow. But I think it's important for us to hear this in the scriptures, but as the psalm brings it to us. Because if, as St. Paul said, the Jews demand signs and the Greeks wisdom, what does our age demand? Do we know? Are we sensitive to what our age is asking and what it's pressing on us? Ease and comfort, largeness and efficiency, our rights, that I am what I do and what I own, influence and power and significance? Do we demand to make a difference? Do we demand to always pursue the better option? Do we demand technique and strategy, relationships and situations that are good for me and get me what I want or I move on? You know, we know these things, and we know more than this because we swim in these waters. And you can fill in other things, perhaps, because I think they've infected how we think and feel and do things, and they are not the values of wisdom. They're not the statutes of the Lord that are just and life-giving. They're the hallmarks of an anxious and self-centered age. So where have we compromised? Where have we let go our attention? I'm just going to ask that question, ask the Spirit to guide us and lead us as we walk in that. This week, Billy Graham was laid to rest. You know, a man of so much influence, really, over 99 years. As a boy, I went to a Billy Graham crusade. I don't know if some of you in here maybe went to a Billy Graham crusade. I remember meeting Archbishop Yong, who was Archbishop of Southeast Asia, and touring the Billy Graham Museum in Wheaton with his wife, taking her through, and there's a film of the Madison Square Garden crusade back in the 50s, and she said, "I was there." She goes, "I was a girl, but I was there." So he touched many people. And his life was complicated at times, right? Especially the, you know, his connection with the political life and so on, and I think that changed a lot after Richard Nixon, after he realized that maybe he'd been used in some ways. Billy Graham said this not too long ago. He said, "To a large extent, the American church has become merged with the world. It has adopted so many of the world's ideals and standards that it has lost its ability to stem the tide of crime, deception, and immorality that is sweeping the nation. For millions of church members, there is no deep commitment to the cause of Christ, no regularity of attendance at public worship, no sacrificial giving, no personal religious discipline." It's good for us just to hear it, to say, "Lord, where are we in this? Where am I in this?" Because in movement 3 of the psalm, this sort of, you know, all comes together, because the psalmist understood the danger of this. The psalmist says, "Cleanse me from my secret faults." He knows that even with the revelation of God's marvelous instructions, it's possible to offend without even knowing it. I think he sounds anxious, personally. I think the end of this psalm is there's anxiety in it, in his response to what's been revealed in nature, and then specifically what's been revealed by the law, the instructions of God to his people. He prays for God's protection. He prays against the hidden sins, but he also prays about the ones he knows are sin, and he just does anyway. I know nobody here does that, but he knows only God can keep him, that in the place of God holding him, he will be whole and sound. Then we have that famous appeal at the end, "May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer." I'm not sure I'll ever hear those words the same again, knowing that they come from this anxious heart that does not want to step out of relationship with God, but knows there's the danger of that. "Lord, please protect me. Lord, let my meditation find favor in you. Let me not go astray." There's a kind of desperation here, a plea to the only one that can save and keep in the face of all that is seeking to draw the psalmist away. It's a good psalm for Lent because it's a psalm of praise. It's not heavy. You know, it doesn't leave us crushed. It's a psalm that is celebratory. It's a psalm that seeks the Lord's wisdom and instruction, but also where we are asked to be shown our areas of compromise, places where we have not loved with a whole heart, where we have not been the church, where we've not done what the church is called to do, which is really to live out as witness the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the gospel. We learn in it where we need to return to the heart of the one who has called us as his own people in a peculiar way, and live by the way he's established for us. After his death, friends went through the various journals that Dag Hammarskjöld had written. And they found in it a prayer that he composed that I think fits this psalm pretty well. And it fits the season that we're in. He wrote this. He says, "Give me a pure heart that I may see you. Give me a humble heart that I may hear you. Give me a heart of love that I may serve you. Give me a heart of faith that I may abide in you." Amen.